Welcome back to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curley away today. He'll be back tomorrow. And Sherry Elliker, as she often does, is filling in for John. I think we just mentioned last hour that there are certain stories that we do all the time. And one of those stories that we've been doing in for feels like forever at Cairo Radio and any other local station around here is deal with the homeless, the issue of the homelessness. We were going to get rid of it. We had a 10-year span. We're going to get rid of it. We ran out of time, didn't quite accomplish that. It continues to be on the front burner. And nine times out of ten, it's a downer of a story. It feels like it's a bad news story. We now have somebody, the hardest working woman in a broadcast, to bring us what I think is being trumpeted as good news about the homeless. Let's bring her on. Here she is, everybody. Hannah Scott, would you characterize this as good news, or at least the trumpeting part of it?
I think it's, I think for sure there's one part of it that's good news, and okay. I think it's hopeful news. That's with some other hopeful news that I've heard throughout the year so far, I think we could be having a recipe for success, possibly. We'll have to wait and see.
Son of a gun. Maybe it's good that John isn't here then. Let's celebrate whatever's upbeat about today's news.
Right. So the for sure good news is that if you've been in downtown Seattle at all in recent weeks, you had seen Third Avenue down by Pike and Pine. Was you just couldn't go there. There had been this more than a couple of dozen tents were erected. It had become this encampment that was just untenable, and it's not there. It is cleaned up, gone, and that is partly because of this program, the Just Care program that I'm going to talk to you about. Councilmember Andrew Lewis is championing this effort.
Living without shelter, are able to get shelter and live with dignity and be well-resourced and be set up to be successful. And that our business owners are put in a position where they no longer have to tolerate on a daily basis the presence of encampments that we know have had a detrimental effect to the quality of life for the folks living in those encampments, as well as folks in the broader community here in the city of Seattle. And we're just here to recognize that it took this team to do it. It took us working together as a city and a county, working together with the Just Care program, which we're here to talk about, and also the city's Hope team, that collaborated and placed 14 people into shelter, the Seattle Parks Department, the Downtown Seattle Association, the Chamber of Commerce.
It's
a lot of people.
It's a lot. So you had all of them partnering together, and that's the difference with this. It almost kind of sounds like what you see from that Compassion Seattle, but it's not quite the same. You've got some local business. So they did this, by the way, this press event today outside the Triple Door for its grand reopening today. And that the guy who owns that is a part of this as well. They got all of the local businesses involved to try to help, and I think they help all the way down the line to get jobs. What they do is they get these people to voluntarily leave these encampments because they offer them a housing first model. So housing first is low barrier, basically. It means you don't have to stay sober or clean to go and get that shelter. And you just have to agree. There's like a big long agreement that they sign, which is that you can only drink or use or whatever it is your thing is on those premises. You can't do it outside. And then they have immediately they've got wraparound services, the people who help you to get to treatment, then help you to get to permanent housing, then help you to get a job or whatever, you know, your license or whatever it is that you need. And that's a very big collaborative effort between the city, the county, all of those others that you just heard, and businesses that teamed up.
Okay, so the reason they think it's successful is because the visual blight of those tents is gone. And that is the thing that those of us who are not dealing on an intimate basis with the homeless, you know, like working in that industry to try to help them, we just say, oh, good, that problem solved. How do they explain or justify the fact that they've done what they've done? How much did it cost? How many people were affected? How long did they take to determine if this is a successful approach?
So 6 months, and that was based on a study that was just released, or report, I should say, out of the UW, and researcher Dr. Catherine Beckett says Just Care is unique in a lot of ways.
In part because it very intentionally engages and serves people who are experiencing unsheltered homelessness. And it's also unique because it's extremely holistic. It's simultaneously a housing first initiative, a health access program, and also a public safety initiative. And thanks to the work of both program staff and DOMS teams, it's able to do that without reliance on the police or the criminal legal system, which has very liberating effects for the people who are involved.
So that's another big part of this. And so they've done this for 6 months, and it's minor. It was like a pilot program. I think they ran it. It started about the beginning of the pandemic, and I'm sorry, I don't know the dollar amount, but it's minor. And it's Chinatown International District, Pioneer Square, and then also we're kind of up to where that part of downtown is, where Third Ave is. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. That's all they've done. Right now, of course, they're saying this is what we're going to do moving forward. Andrew Lewis says we're leaning into this. He's going to want more money from the city, from the county, as we go through the budget process in the weeks and months ahead. But so you have LEAD is part of this and co-LEAD, which is basically the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program during COVID. Nicole is an outreach worker with the co-lead.
What this means is that you'll find me daily in encampments building relationships with somebody's mother, brother, and favorite auntie. The Just Care approach is a client-centered and trauma-informed approach. We work to build trust and understanding with our folks so that we can focus services and be responsive to individual needs. We work with the chronically unsheltered adult who have unsupported mental health disabilities and problematic drug use. Aligning services and bringing folks inside is the first step to breaking homelessness.
So she goes out over and over and over again, like those social workers that we saw teaming up with cops for a while, if you recall. And it's a different, it's not an aggressive approach, not a policing approach. It's a we're getting to know you approach. How can I help you where you are? You know, you hear that term a lot. Mm-hmm. We meet them where they are, that kind of a thing.
Okay, so all sorts of questions here. At this point, this sounds like it would be good on paper, but they are basing this on what, a year's worth of experiment that they've taken these people voluntarily, as you say, and have they fixed up their lives? I can't imagine you could, if somebody's a drug addict or somebody's mentally ill, how they feel like they can be successful in 6 to 9 months or whatever.
And some of them are. In fact, I believe they spoke about one who has become a peer. I think it's peer specialists, where they come and they get clean and then they turn around and they help do the same thing that someone just did for them. And that is a huge, huge effort right now to expand our use of those who've got lived experience, who've been through this. You get more trust that way from those who are living in encampments when you're talking to somebody who's kind of been where you are, that kind of thing, and who can be understanding about it. It's basically what you are likely to see. I think this will play into our reimagined public safety down the line as well, where you see community groups. Like there was a Dominic Davis, who is normally part of Community Passageways, but also involved in another community group. He's also a part of this effort as well.
It humanizes the people that we walk by every day, that sit in these encampments, that are out here on these corners asking for change, and we just walk by them. It's time for us to keep doing something for them now. Like, let's humanize them. Let's put them in a space where they can be successful, get the services they need, have some compassion, some empathy, and some love for them, and build them up so that they can walk down a different path and see some light at the end of the tunnel. Right now, can you imagine having to live out here every day? Can you imagine having to beg for food and having to go get services and navigate services every day? I can't imagine that. So I don't want to have to imagine that, and I don't think other people should have to. So this is what this is all about, being able to serve our community. WDC has a team of people from the communities, from the streets, from the systems, that the people that are being served, the participants that are being served through Just Cares. We walk alongside with them. They understand them. They know them. They come from those communities, and they've been through training, and we've been able to hire them, put them in a place where they're making a really good living wage, serving the community.
So that's the peer stuff I'm talking about. Yeah, go ahead, Sherry.
Sorry, I have a question for you. Sure. So you said that they don't have any real requirements in terms of making sure that you're clean when you get into this program, that you can use drugs or drink or whatever while you're in the program, while you're physically housed where they have you. Is there some time limit on that? Like, obviously the objective is going to be to try to get as many people clean and try to get them into society with jobs so they can get on with their lives. But is there something that they're doing as far as saying, you know, you have a year, you have 2 years, or is it too early in the program to make those determinations?
As far as I've seen, there's not any limit on that. And basically, when you're talking about a housing first or harm reduction model, what they know is that people are going to slip, if you will, or relapse, right? So you have to get them housed and with a roof over their head for a while so they can have those chances to do that. And then eventually, with this ongoing effort and this constant wraparound services that are like with them all the time, navigating them through all of these processes, then eventually it sticks. And that's what I've heard from everyone who deals from whether we're talking about the opioid crisis all the way through to the homeless crisis and where those two things meet. It's that is the only thing that they see that actually works. Picking people up, arresting them for the minor crimes and turning them back out, that doesn't work. Then we have our prolific offenders. So this, they, by the way, Tom, in answering your earlier question, 33 people out of the 42, I believe, that there were there on Third Avenue, went voluntarily into this program. And so far, so good. I think 13% or 13 people who could not safely go into their housing program, which basically means that whatever it is that they're doing is too dangerous for those around them, or, you know, they can't
be helped.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Because that was going to be my wrap-up question was, John always brings up the point that, you know, Tom, some of these people don't want to be helped. They don't want to be cured. They want to just be left alone, and that, you know, that this is not the solution. Some people, he insists, prefer to live on the streets. I was wondering how you handled, how this group handles, Just Cares handles, recalcitrant people. If there was somebody living in a tent on Third Avenue, they've just swept up Third Avenue. If somebody didn't want to go, would they leave them alone? At what point does it get a little messy?
And it was clean all the way through this morning. And I know there were those few that didn't want to go or could not be housed there. But it was done humanely. That's what they said. I'm not sure. I think that Parks was involved in this and all the various city departments. They take the stuff if they need to so that the people can get it and do it in a way where, you know, they're not losing. It's not like you saw at, say, Cal Anderson Park a while back where they're kicking the tents up and that kind of thing. It's all very cordial, I guess, would be the word I would use. So they want to invest more in this moving forward. They say that this is done. They also, I should say, the UW, when they did their study and their report, is they talked to the outreach workers. They had a series of questions they asked them. They talked to the people who voluntarily left the encampment and everyone who was involved to see how this was working. And their assessment was that this could work or is working on this small scale, and if brought to scale, could be transformative for the region.
Is this, you mentioned it's similar to Compassion Seattle. You know, we've got this charter amendment issue that's going to come up. You know, everyone's working on solutions because so far nothing else has worked. Is this in competition now with this? Does this have, say, I noticed that you have a council member there. Does this have any mayoral support, any city support, or is this sort of like outside most governmental resources?
And I believe Andrew Lewis said he is teaming up a little bit with the mayor on this. I haven't had a chance to ask myself what she's doing. And I don't think it's in competition with that charter amendment. Okay. I believe because you've got the Downtown Seattle Association involved with both of those.
With both,
So I think that they might complement each other should that charter amendment pass. And I think this is something new. The thing that's going to matter about this is if we do put more funding towards this, let it happen. Let it play out. Let's, you know, I'm always leery when we're going into election, when there's going to be a new mayor and, you know, maybe, who knows, at large seats that are new. Anything can happen once you start to do something like this, when you get a new, you know, a mayor or whomever in charge. So you've got to let these things play out. They snip it too soon and they don't let it play out.
Is there any kind of internal squabbling on the council? Like, I know this is like sounds like Andrew Lewis's baby. Is there much resistance because of him with the others?
Not that I have heard just yet, but, you know, budget season is just around the corner, and I'm sure that conversation will come into play. I really don't know that it should be that. This includes the kind of things that you've heard from even some of the most far to the left council members, right, where we are being very humane with those that we clear. It's not really, I wouldn't describe this as a sweep. And the housing first model, all of that is what has been pushed for a long time with most of these council members.
The key is housing first. That's even if this is the ideal model, we have to have housing first to offer housing first. I mean, affordable housing is the constant, you know, need that we have that right now we haven't been able to fulfill. And I know everybody and his mother is working on creating affordable housing. The question is, how quickly can we scale up if this really is a workable model?
But. So here's the thing. Yeah, and it will take a little bit of time. But what they do right now is the people that they clear and get off the streets voluntarily go into their temporary housing for 6 to 9 months to be part of this program. And then they transition to permanent supportive housing, which we have some of. We don't have enough of. But there's more going online all over for the next several, 2 years, I think we've got it planned out, and the hope is to do more some of that federal dollars. So
this is
not going to be enough in the end. They'll have to keep doing it, but.
But this is transition. That's an interesting distinction. I didn't pick up on that. That this is like a 6 to 9 month transitional thing. That wherever we're putting these people that were on Third Avenue, they're only going to be where they are now for 6 to 9 months, and then hopefully they'll end up in what's considered legitimate, real, long lasting, affordable housing.
Is this, this seems like a win-win, obviously, Hannah.
It was called that, yeah.
I mean, it really is. I mean, it's a great program. All of these programs sound terrific. Is the financial will there to keep this going? Like, if they can show that this is really working and that people don't go back to the streets, is everybody kind of on the same page about keeping this going and being able to fund it?
Again, I've not heard from other council members or candidates about this, but it is very similar to what I've heard them speak about as far as their priorities and goals as anybody who's running for office and that kind of thing. And for funding wise, there's a big chunk of money still that they're going through that's coming from the federal government from COVID that can be used to in part with this. And they've also already teamed up with King County. And remember, we've got our regional homeless agency now. So the county will have to be a part of that. So I do believe, yes, that there is support for that in that funding. There's still, I don't think there's going to be enough funding to get it all the way to scale. But I think that the fact that you have LEED involved is absolutely huge. And all of the different kind of providers, and you heard, I think, Andrew Lewis say it in that first soundbite, is that they're all working together, not competing or out trying to outbid each other for various city contracts. It's a very different approach when they are just doing this together and there's no bidding involved.
Fair enough. I think so.
Is the answer short.
Yep. So yes, as housing stories go or homelessness stories go, that is about as upbeat as we've ever been, I think, on
if nothing
our show.
Else, Third Avenue is clean. It was nice.
That's right.
This morning,
everybody drive by Third Avenue if you're downtown. Take a look, see. But keep traffic moving if you can. Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Hannah. We'll let Hannah go. Bye, bye, Hannah. And hello, Tracy. You're listening to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Dagny here, Sherry Elliger filling in for John Curley. And now, Muckleshoot Casino's best and finest is on the horizon. Rachel? Our own uptown girl, Rachel Bell, joins us.
Hi, Tom.
To talk about kids.
Hi, Sherry. Hi, Rachel. Hi, guys. Okay, I love this story. And as I always say when I do a story like this, it's what everybody listening wants, a childless person giving her opinion on how to raise your children. So buckle up, get ready to get
mad.
We call
it objective.
Yeah, that's right. You guys are too deep in it. You can't even see your way out. So
the forest for the trees.
Yeah. So this comes from New York Times Magazine, and it was written by an author, and it's titled, Don't Play With Your Kids. Seriously. So this woman has three kids, and she starts the article by saying how well her children are playing together. But she says, you know, it wasn't always the case. When she just had her first son, he was, I'll use my own words, a nightmare. This kid, she said, was always running into traffic and like tearing apart the couch and chewing on the couch cushions and just really, really hard to take care of. And so by the end of a day when she was always trying to wrangle him and always saying no, 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 and stop all day, she didn't feel like playing with him. She didn't play with him how he wanted, which was kind of a lot of full body contact. And so she always felt really guilty and frustrated because she wasn't a good playmate. She was just tired and somebody who was always saying no. So they tried something new, because when she was growing up, she said, my parents didn't really play with us. Like, we played on our own, or we played with our siblings and our friends. So she didn't really go into detail of how they did this as much, but she started to just like have her kid play by himself. And then as the siblings came along, sometimes they play together, sometimes they won't. But she has found that it's better for both parties. She does not like to play. She said that's just not something that she likes. And I know the feeling, you know, when I've been around friends' kids and we're having a good time and they ask me to play something. Some of these games for four-year-olds are not fun for adults. So she says, my motto is, moms don't play. She said, I don't like to play, especially pretend. Nothing with dolls or figures or any games that ask me to hide or wield a Nerf gun. But she says, when they do get together, when everybody does want to do the same thing, it's really great because they all want to be there. And she says, you know, I'm not a neglectful mom. Quote, I may not play, but I'm goofy and affectionate, and I love to talk about feelings. I love to teach kids how to count, how to read, how to make guacamole. What do you say to this, Tom? Were you a dad who played with his kids? And
so,
Sherry, I don't know what your situation is.
Yes, so I'll go first, and then I think Sherry will be able to add a kind of another outside perspective then. So my personal experience, so I grew up with four brothers. Five of us. I mean, we had our own basketball team. We played with each other all the time. My parents would turn us, we had this, you know, a relatively nice big backyard, and we had something called the dirt pile, and it was probably about, you know, 12 yards by 5 yards. It was just this huge thing, and we just would dig in the dirt pile, and we'd have our trucks in it. It was, I do not remember playing much, especially outside, with my parents. Ever. But then I had four other brothers to deal with, so there wouldn't have been room for a parent anyway. Sometimes inside, you know, we would play, you know, board games, but mostly my parents were, I thought they were great parents, but they were more hands-off. I, however, and I feel like my generation, and I'm in my 60s, so it's not like I'm the young generation. My kids are now the new generation. But I feel like my generation felt like they needed to interact more with their kids, and I definitely played a lot more with my daughters. Now, I was into sports, and I would have loved to have had somebody more into sports. I spent a lot of time playing catch with my daughters when they were, like, playing baseball, not because, you know, they wanted me to. It's because I sort of felt like, well, that's sort of what fathers do. And they, you know, I mean, they were appreciative because they had some of my time, but they didn't really care as much as I did about the fact that we're playing, you know, playing ball in the backyard. So it's, I think it all depends. It's all kind of a balance of what their needs are and, you know, what your needs are. I felt that this writer was pretty self-serving, though. Like, she has certain tendencies. She doesn't like to play this and that. And so she justifies it by saying, hey, they don't need me anyway. It's better off if they learn how to play themselves. I thought that was a little, she was kind of like a sort of a CYA move, and that she maybe deserved to be a little guilty. But overall, it's all a balance. Okay, Sherry, you.
Well, I don't have kids, Rachel, so I can relate to your perspective as well. And I don't remember my parents really playing with us either. My sister and mm-hmm. I played Barbies. Like, we played Barbies all day long, and then we'd trade clothes, and we'd do all this stuff. But then when my sister had her daughter, and I would play with her, I actually loved to play with her. I had so much fun because I could be a kid again. But the one thing I didn't like to do, which seems weird, is read to her. For some reason, I found kids' books so ungodly boring. And then she'd want to hear it, you know, the same over and over
again.
And then I'd make up new words that weren't in the book, and she knew it. And she'd say, no, stick to the story, you know. But just this weekend, my husband's nephew came over, and he has three children under six. And
wow.
I was terrified for my white couch and my other stuff. But, you know, they really did what this woman did. They put them, we went upstairs. We have a loft upstairs at the top of our townhouse, and let the kids up there by themselves. I was waiting for the broken bones or whatever. But they entertained themselves. They were fine. They hung out. They didn't want us around. They wanted to do their own thing. So I think she does make some sense here about backing off and letting them have the time to make their own imaginations work as much as you doing it for them.
Yeah, I think there's
you,
a middle
Rachel?
Ground because, you know, I remember playing Candyland with my parents and playing games, but I don't remember my mom ever getting on the floor and playing Barbies or hide and seek and things like that. I think they picked and chose what was at least a little interesting to them because, you know, as a parent, I know that you have to make a lot of sacrifices. And does part of that have to be playing with your child all the time if you don't want to? You know, I mean, it's not like you're not with your kid enough or giving them attention. I think there's a difference between the playing and I'm not sure like what the result is because it seems like, you know, you definitely want to teach your kids some independence and not become, let's say you have one child only. That's a lot for the rest of their entire childhood that you have to be their playmate. I mean, when would you get anything done ever? So yeah, I don't have
anything to do when you're a parent. That's all you have to do is take care of your kid, work with your kid. You have no other life, Rachel.
What about cleaning the house and cooking and, you know, doing those kind of taking care of? So
then you put them on your hip.
Yeah, that's what the baby Bjorn's for. They need them for 13-year-olds.
Exactly. I don't think we've solved anything, but I do think that the each generation feels like they ought to be doing more and more with their kids. And there comes a point at which mothering becomes smothering. And I think that this article really does a good job of saying, you know what? Kids need to learn their own, you know, be relying on themselves and their sense of imagination. And I think it helps, however, if you have more siblings. I think an only child is a tougher road to hoe for parents, I think.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Rachel.
Become playmate and everything else.
Yes, exactly. Although, like Norman Mailer, I know he was an only child and he was doted on over, and he had such an overweening sense of himself that he ended up becoming this a great writer, but also impossible to live with. So they're good things.
There you go.
Bad things,
there's your proof.
Yeah, perfect.
Smart, but not fun to be around. Norman Mailer.
Exactly. Okay, thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right. All right, you're listening to the Tom and Curly Show here. Tom Tangney, John Curly away today, Sherry Elliker filling in. This next story, I was thinking, if I had stock in Waffle House, if I, you know, ever worked in a Waffle House, if I even had any kind of loyalty to Waffle House, I'm not sure I appreciate this story, but apparently I have no, just so, I've seen Waffle Houses, but I've never been in one. When my daughter, I went to school in North Carolina, we drove by a lot of them, but I don't have any personal experience with Waffle Houses, but apparently they're deemed worthy of some kind of punishment. This story that we're about to do, Sherry, is about a fantasy football league whose punishment for the guy who scored the lowest was to spend 24 straight hours in a Waffle House. And the only condition that was placed upon him was that he could shorten the 24 hours by a pancake an hour. So if he managed to eat, I mean, no, not pancake, a waffle. If he managed to wolf down one waffle, then that would knock off an hour, so he would only have to be there for 23 hours. Mm-hmm. And the more waffles, each waffle he managed to get down, he could knock off the hours. And it turns out that this guy managed, over the course of 24 hours, a measly 9 waffles. So that meant he had to spend 15 straight hours. He tweeted about this. It was an online sensation. He had tens of thousands of followers by the end. And I just have to ask you, how hard is it to wolf down a waffle? Is there something? I don't understand. I love waffles. It feels to me I could eat 24 waffles in an hour if it was up to me. So clearly I'm out of my element here. Can you help me, Sherry?
Well, sure. I kind of agree with you. The drama around him eating the waffles was sort of extraordinary. I mean, at 4:24, he says, after two waffles, two, mind you, already my stomach is rumbling. At 5:18, he says, two more waffles and one human who is dead on the inside. After four waffles, I am already in immense discomfort. Please, somebody, launch me into the sun. I mean, he was really feeling sorry for himself. And I agree with you. I mean, waffles, they can be filling, if you pile on the syrup and the butter and all of that other stuff. But they're not like, you know, I mean, he's not eating, you know, a pan of creme brulee and, you know, prime rib. I mean, it's a waffle. So I kind of am wondering if he did this to try to get more attention, because he really did have, he had 62,000 people on Twitter following him.
That's just hilarious. And yeah, the physical discomfort. Now, I think, I'm trying to remember now, did they not talk to Waffle House? Like, I think Waffle House said they had nothing to say or something. So it just, it feels like, I guess, you know, there is that argument. There's no such thing as bad publicity. We are now spending 5 minutes talking about Waffle House. That can only be good for Waffle House. That's the theory, at least. But now right. I'd be leery. The fact that I never visited Waffle House wasn't because I was leery of waffles. I love waffles. I just, you know, didn't get around to it. But now I think I might actually, you know, pause a bit before I, you know, pulled into a Waffle House after reading this article. But
well,
maybe
believe
we can...
it or not, Tom, Go this ahead. Isn't the first one. There's actually a thing called the Waffle House Challenge. And so it's becoming a thing. And so you may be able to pull into one and actually see one in motion if you get lucky.
Maybe they're designed to be indigestible, and then that's their point.
Could
how many
be.
Of these if you've got contests? Oh, well, I'm sure we'll hear from all of you out there who testify to the greatness or the lack thereof of Waffle House waffles. Let us know in the text line. 98973. Okay, boy, it's 4:54, and it's still hot. I heard we're hitting 90 in some spots of Seattle, and now, Tracy, do your best to make this cool down, please.
I wish. And for one that who had lived in the South there for a couple of years, who frequent the Waffle House many, many a nights,
yeah.
I will say it really does a number on your tummy.
It does. So they really are gut bombs, huh?
Yeah, they just, you can't eat for, like, I would say anywhere between 24 to 36 hours after.
Oh, my gosh. Like... We should have brought you in earlier, Tracy.
Yeah.
That's great.
You know, the only thing that I loved about the Waffle House was the smothered and covered hash browns.
Oh,
and
hash browns are the best.
So,
yeah.
So diner hash browns for the win.